Welcome to History, Books, and Wine,
where three author friends talk about books
and fun historical tidbits,
all while raising a glass of vino.
We're your hosts, Lori Ann Bailey,
Eliza Knight,
and Madeline Martin. So, pour a glass and enjoy the show. Welcome to episode 25 of History, Books, and Wine podcast. Thank you so much for joining us for our sixth happy hour where you get all three of us. And you're forewarned that this week we might be a little crazy. We've had a lot going on. We're actually recording while the kids are awake, which usually we don't do that. So if you hear fighting in the background or any loud crashes or noises, they're fine. They're fine. We're just going to drink a little bit more wine this time. So for those of you who don't know me, I'm Madeline Martin, a USA Today bestselling author of historical romance with page-turning action, tough heroines, and the men who are strong enough to love them.
And I am Lori Ann Bailey, a National Reader's Choice and Holt Medallion award-winning author who writes Scottish historicals with hot Highland heroes and spunky independent lasses finding their perfect matches in the Scottish Highlands.
Good evening from the Old Orchard Beach in Maine, where you may hear my family running around because I'm recording this from my bedroom on the first floor. I am Eliza Knight, USA Today bestselling author of Scottish historical romance with irresistible heroes, courageous heroines, and daring adventure. Under my name, E. Knight, I write Rip Your Heart Out historical fiction that crosses landscapes around the world.
All right. Yes, and this episode was very difficult to plan because we've all been on summer vacation and at conferences and have just had family stuff going on, electricity going out. But we're finally here and we're finally ready to have our wine and record.
Yes, and I don't think we ever push it. We've never gone this close to the actual release day of the podcast. Like, it's Tuesday. No, wait, today's Wednesday.
Yeah, it's Wednesday.
And this is going up tomorrow morning.
Yes.
So today we'll be talking about fun accessories, which we've been talking about different garments and things like that over the past few weeks. So today we're gonna dig into wigs, purses, and belts.
Yay! But first, we need to talk about what we're drinking. I opened this bottle last night because my power went out when we were originally supposed to record last night, and my kids lost all their electronics, so all of a sudden they wanted all of my attention, and before the day was over, I needed wine. So this one has a really cool gothic-looking label on it with a skeleton on the top.
Ooh!
And it's called Curious Beasts. It's a blood red wine. I couldn't find a description for this on a website. They didn't have one that I could find. So I found a description from winescores.ca. Not only is the bottle just really gothic and cool looking, but it comes with a cork that looks like it has blood dripping down it, and so does the barcode on the back of the bottle.
That's awesome. I want that right now.
But here's the little description I found that is not from their website. It is, "Curious beasts will certainly pique your visual interest. The label perfectly gothic and bloody looking. This wine is a red blend that offers black fruits, chocolate, spiced plums, and leather with savory undertones. The palate follows suit. It's supple and has good freshness. Cherry, black plum flavors with oodles of chocolate and blackberry trailing on the finish. It will pair with dark chocolate, spiked with chilies would be great, or serve with grilled meats or chili con mole."
Yum.
And it is really
yummy. Now I'm hungry.
Tonight I'm drinking a Josh Rosé. And for those of you who listened to our past podcast, you know I am a huge fan of Josh, but I normally buy the red. And when I was at the store this week, I saw on an end cap at the wine store the rosé, which I've never had before. So I bought that, and I am really enjoying it. It's really, really crisp and refreshing, which is interesting because from their website it says crisp and refreshing. And
it's like they know.
Yeah.
They knew. Our rosé is perfect for sunsets and warm summer days. Yes, it is. It is very warm where I am. And this wine is light and easy to drink with flavors of white peach and strawberry and hints of nectarine. And from Joseph Carr, the founder of Josh Cellars, he says, rosé was one of the first wines I ever tried. Our rosé takes me back to memories of carefree, warm summer days with family and good friends.
Yum. Mm-hmm. I'm a huge fan of Josh, too.
They're great. Like, I discovered them a few years ago, and it's sort of just like one of my go-tos. If I'm not sure what I want, I just grab Josh, and I love them.
Josh likes you ladies, too.
Yes.
He better all the money we're spending on them.
For real, though. But yeah, that wine is really good. So I'm going back to one of my classic favorites with Apothic. I love all the Apothic brand, or all the Apothic wines. And tonight I'm drinking Apothic Dark, a bold and opulent blend. Apparently, Lori, you and I kind of have like a more gothic wine kind of thing going on this summer.
We do.
So this dark red blend features fruit flavors of blueberry and blackberry with opulent notes of coffee and dark chocolate. And from the website it says, there's romance and darkness. It draws our curiosity and beckons a desire to taste the unknown.
Ooh, I like
what
that
a cool
line.
Description.
Yeah.
Okay, you guys, if you haven't gone to the Apothic, I know I was ranting about this on one of my other podcasts before. If you have not gone to apothic.com, you have to. All of their descriptions are just luxurious like that. They're just fantastic. And it's just like total eye candy, too. It's the best website I've ever been to for wine.
That's cool.
I will have to visit it.
It's really cool.
And we're ready to get started tonight with handbags. And that will be me. I'm first up. And handbags have been an essential part of daily life for as long as people have had something precious to carry around. The first written mention of handbags comes in literature during the 14th century, but Egyptian hieroglyphics show pouches carried around the waist much earlier. And that made me really happy to find that because I was talking about hieroglyphics in my jewelry podcast weeks ago.
Yes, you sure did.
Yes. Bags were attached to what are called girdles. And I did look ahead at our script here. And I know Eliza will be explaining girdles in just a few minutes. So you'll get more detail on that. And they were embroidered with jewels and adorned. And these were used to show status. The richer the person, the more elaborate the bag. So here are my fun facts about purses. From the 16th century, women often wore a decorative bag, which was clasped on at the waist, and it held a series of chains that dangled down from it. This was called a chatelaine. Suspended from it were useful household accessories such as scissors, keys, sewing tools, and vinaigrettes, which are also known as smelling salts. These were crafted from precious metals and were considered as jewelry and status symbols. And let me tell you, I've seen some pictures of these things and they are amazing. It's really cool to see the little pieces dangling down.
I wish we kind of still carried stuff like that because I can't tell you how many times, like, I'm digging through my purse, like, oh, I just wish that I had this one tool. Or earlier this week when we were putting together fans, I'm like, I need a screwdriver. I wish I had, like, a Swiss Army knife or something. Mm-hmm. Like, and I actually thought about the chatelaines. I was like, oh. The housekeepers always had those things like dangling on there.
Yes,
that is awesome.
Did.
And imagine the kids. How many times the kids go in my purse? I could be like, just get the dangly bit.
Yeah. The dangly bit right there.
So, fact number two. Early Europeans used handbags, just as we do today, to store personal belongings that they needed for the day. Clothing had no pockets until the 17th century, so men also carried handbags around for things like coins, alms, and relics. The sporran played a similar role in the Highlands of Scotland.
Woo!
It was, part utilitarian, part symbol of wealth and status. They were typically made of leather or fur, and the ornamentation of the sporran is chosen to complement the formality of the dress worn with it. Not a dress as in a gown dress. But...
The
sporran is worn on a leather strap or chain and positioned in front of the groin of the wearer.
Convenient.
Yes. Indeed. And fact number three about handbags tonight. The 17th and 18th century ladies preferred to carry their valuables and necessities in small bags with drawstrings. These were known as reticules in France and indispensables in England. They were similar to a modern handbag. Some women had been carrying personal belongings in pockets tied around the waist, but the columnar or vertical skirts and thin fabrics that had come into style in the Regency era made pockets essentially unusable. So the reticule became popular, and it was usually held together with a drawstring at the top and was carried over the arm on a cord or a chain.
Have you guys ever seen those old school pockets?
Yes.
Those were awesome. Like, yeah. I would love, those things were so big.
And
so for those of you who are listening, yeah, like they, so you know those big, the big dresses that the ladies had, like where their hips were massive? Mm-hmm. Well, that stuff had pockets underneath, yeah. And those pockets, you could put like a kid in there. Like,
yeah.
They get too heavy to hold, stick it in your pocket. Like, yeah. they were incredible though.
Anybody hungry, I have a whole loaf of bread in my pocket.
Right, exactly. If you need some wine, I've got that in the left pocket. Like, honestly, I probably...
Whole snack picnic in my pocket.
Right?
Yeah.
But can you imagine, like, I know myself, I'd be like, only put some lip balms, some hairpins.
Yep,
I'd be walking around. I would be jangling so loud.
Yep.
Like, people would hear me coming.
You wouldn't
so
need a chatelaine.
Like, going up the stairs with your pocket so full like that. That reminds me of something funny that happened last week. So, have you ever heard of Cupshe, like the bathing suit website?
No.
So I went on there and I found like a few bathing suits I liked and I ordered them. And when they came, they fit everywhere but the top chest area. And it was making the chest area look extremely inappropriate, as it only covered like the top half, not the bottom half. So some serious underboob going on. So I was like, all right, girls, well, clearly this is not going to work for me at the beach this week. Why don't one of you, like, you know, both of you try it on, see what happens. And for Danielle, they fit fine. And then for Ash, she tried one in. She has, like, a much narrower rib cage than all of us. So she had, like, these, like, huge pocket areas in the top of the bathing suit.
Oh, that's hilarious.
And she was like, she's like, oh, wait, hold on, I'll be right back. And I was like, okay. So she came back, and she had shoved, like, water bottles, packs of peanuts, some, like, a block of cheese. And, like,
oh, my gosh.
Of, like,
that is so funny.
She's like, I
that's
came
great.
Prepared. This bathing suit had pockets for all my snacks. So we just made me think of that weird time.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Well, we know what she'd be putting in her pocket in her dress.
Yeah. Cheese.
Yeah.
Totally,
I like
essential.
The way she thinks.
Yes.
All right, so I'm going next, and I'm getting wiggy with it with wigs.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm kicking it back to Egypt also. They are the ones that also had the earliest wigs, or at least the wigs that were done right. They didn't really mention any other civilization really using them before Egypt. But basically, they did it because they wanted to keep their heads cooler because it was so hot there. And they also didn't like having gray or white hair, so they would try to dye their hair with henna, but it wasn't always available. Mm-hmm. So the interesting thing, too, is that slaves and servants were not allowed to wear wigs, nor were they allowed to shave their heads.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. And those original wigs, they were also done by class, like what you were talking about with the purses.
Mm-hmm.
So they were made from things like vegetable fibers, like linen. That was the really cheap ones that poorer people would wear. You could wear wool or animal hair for middle class, I guess.
Oh my god, that sounds so hot.
I was thinking the same thing. Can you imagine, like, nothing like this big wool hair slung over your head in
out
Egypt,
the Egyptian sun.
Right? And then the most expensive that really only royalty would even use was all human hair.
And they had to scalp somebody to get that.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. They didn't say where they got it from.
Yeah.
But the wealthier you were, the more wigs that you had, and they would actually be buried with them. They were styled with scented animal fat for the less expensive ones.
Yum.
Can you imagine that getting a little warm and steamy? Like, especially if it had like a lavender, like, oh, it smells like lavender and pig.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I can't even imagine. But they could dye it, they could do all kinds of beads and everything. Nefertiti particularly preferred to do dark black wigs, and they were shaped like in a helmet sort of a shape. And these sometimes got kind of crazy, like one queen had a wig so large that was so elaborate, she needed to have her servants help her stand up.
Oh, that's crazy.
I don't know if you guys ever saw Kim Kardashian with her camp dress, the one that had, like, the water droplets that came down and everything.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
No.
So it reminded me of that because it was, like, I don't know, it was the Met Gala. They did, like, the camp, whatever, the camp theme, which I don't even actually know what that means, but I'm not stylish, so whatever, I don't care. But so she was supposed to wear this dress. It was supposed to look like she was coming out of the water with, like, water droplets coming down. And she said that it was so tight because she had, like, this professional corset that she had to stand up on the way there. And she couldn't, like, sit down or anything. And she said she couldn't pee. And I was like, uh-uh, no, I would never be able to wear that. I'd last, like, 10 minutes. I'd be like, no, I need a catheter to wear this.
Yep.
It'll totally ruin the look, but whatever, man. But it just reminded me of that, like, having to have somebody help you stand up because your wig is so elaborate. Like, fashion. But then also they had the beard wig, which, you know, the old pharaohs that had the beard wig. So that was usually human hair, and it was braided and tucked around, and it was attached by hooking, like, cupping the chin, and then hooked onto the back of the ears, which does not sound comfortable.
Hilarious.
So then we don't hear anything about wigs from the 1200s to the 1400s because women covered up their hair. So the wigs kind of fell out of practice. Until everyone started getting syphilis. So one of the side effects of syphilis is that your hair falls out and you also get weeping sores. And so wigs were a great way of hiding that. So my second fact is that wigs were brought back into fashion by Louis the 13th, who was also rumored to have syphilis. He was known for having these luxurious locks that over time had started to get thinner. And I don't know if he just didn't have a nicely shaped bald head or what. But he decided instead of going bald and shaving his head that he would bring the wigs back. So he got really crazy with it, and some of his wigs would take hair from up to 10 heads to make his wig.
Oh, that's
like, talk
insane.
About overcompensating.
Yes.
Like, that thing would be like a lion's mane.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
His favorite hair to get were women from the country because their hair was usually kept wrapped up around their heads with, like, a something over the top of it, so it kept their hair pure. Yeah.
It was untainted by the sun.
I will have a wig of 10 virgins, please.
Yes, exactly. Oh, gosh. All right. So then heads were generally shaved to accommodate the wigs because they were so big that you really couldn't have hair. And a small cap was placed underneath to make it a little bit more comfortable. And also because you're, like, bee sweating underneath that 10 heads of human hair.
Oh, my God.
It's for real.
I don't understand how it made them cooler for the Egyptians to wear it. Like,
I know.
Like, it's crazy.
I know. It's crazy. Especially the wool. Like, right. I can't even imagine how
it
awful
it probably protected them from sunburns, but
that's
it had
true.
To have been hot as...
I guess. I don't know. Like, that's just crazy. They need, like, moisture wicking wool or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the way that the wigs were styled is they had clay rollers that were heated and they were curled. They were curled with that. But obviously that was best done with the wig off. And they would often pomade the wig before applying the hair powder. That's what helped it stick. And in some cases that could add up to 2 pounds to the weight of the wig.
Wow.
Can you imagine having so much of that powder?
No.
So the reason powdering also became popular for a couple of reasons. One is because white hair was really popular, but white hair wigs were not very common to find because they couldn't get human hair that was white because they were all shorter and frazzled and everything. So powder was easier. But also, wigs sometimes got stinky.
Mm-hmm.
And so the powder that was made out of things like ground up orange flower, lavender, or its root, things that have nice smells to them. So it really was also done to help cover up the odor of the hair. And the way that they were cleaned, and I thought this was interesting, you would send them back to your wig maker and they would boil them. Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy. You think that would damage the hair.
You would think so. But, I mean, it's just human hair. So
yeah, I guess it's like when you take, like, a hot... I mean, it's a little hotter than a hot
bath. I know. It's a little hotter than what we bathed in.
Yeah.
I mean, I've taken some hot baths, man.
Yeah.
Not boiling,
though. Oh, gosh. But, yes. So, anyways, I thought all that stuff was interesting. So, women actually didn't really... Well, it says that they didn't wear wigs, but they wore artificial hair with their hair, which is kind of like wigs.
Yeah.
So, I guess,
like,
it's like our
kind of
extensions.
Like extensions.
Yeah. Extensions with, like, a bump it, you know?
Yeah.
You guys remember those bump it?
Yes. Oh, my God. people still wear those bumpets today. Like some.
I think they do.
I could never get it to work. I tried one once.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
I never tried it.
I'm just not talented enough.
Me either. They have a new thing going around Facebook that I've seen like a video for, and it's like a hair, a braided hair headband, and like people are wearing that.
I never look good in those things. It always looks like a big chunk of fake hair stuck on my head. Like, oh my gosh, is that a rat in your hair? No. It's my braid. Oh, it looks nice.
What do you mean
Thanks.
You don't like my braid?
Right. Of course, I'm like a walking Pinterest fail anyways, but...
Oh my gosh, I can't try any of those things.
No, I can't either.
They're like, it's so easy, and I'll spend like 2 hours doing it, and then I want to just shave my head.
Yeah.
If I had the ears to do it, I probably would have done it a long time ago.
I tried doing this like really cute, like half... It's like, you know, you pull your hair up halfway... to make like a cute little bun and then leave the rest down, and it's supposed to look super cute, and when I did it, it just looked like I had a giant muffin on top of my head. And then I did not know how to do my hair. It looked horrible.
Well, and my hair is so thin.
Mine too.
These girls all have like 10 heads worth of hair on their heads.
Yes.
And I've got like half of one.
Yeah, I look like I had a mullet and a muffin.
Yeah.
Like, this is not the look. Not how it was on.
No, I've done some like that too. My hair is too thin to ever do any of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, mine is too.
But both men and women did actually powder their hair, although it did start to kind of fall off in the trend. And it was completely killed off in 1795 when a tax was put on powder to help fund the war. So, yeah. Fact number three is that women had some crazy wigs in the 18th century. So in the mid to late 1770s, huge hair was all the rage. And when I say huge hair, I mean like 1 to 1.5 times the size of their face. The higher, the better.
That's crazy.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, your poor neck.
I know. I can't even imagine. They used what was referred to as a torque. It was either made from cork or from fabric, and it was shaped sort of like an upside, like a heart. And they would attach that to the head so that it went like a heart above from like the top of your head up, you know?
Yeah.
And they would then pin all kinds of fake hair and adornments to it and just sort of build up from there. And then they would attach your natural hair to it. Sometimes it would be powdered, sometimes it wouldn't. All kinds of crazy stuff. But after you had it, oh, and these were the ones, if you've ever seen... The women, they would actually have, like, bird cages in their hair.
Holy
or it would be, like, an entire...
I have seen that before.
Yeah, or, like, a pirate ship.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys ever watched... Oh, I think the name of the movie is Captain Jack McClane or something like that. But this one woman in this particular movie, because it was set during this time period... And this was in France, by the way. But she was watching somebody being hung who had offended her. And so in her hair, she wore a gallows with little skeletons dangling from it.
Oh, that's crazy.
And I could totally see that actually happening in history, because they were kind of crazy. But yeah, they had all kinds of... They would just do, like, themes and everything. Well, it took so much time and effort and money to build these hair pieces... that they were worn for days on end, and sometimes even weeks.
How did they sleep?
So, I'm glad that you asked that, because I did research on that, too. Because that was my thought. And, like, I know, like, with the geishas, because they do the same, like, a similar, well, not similar, but they get their hair styled, and they aren't allowed to sleep in it, and so they have, like, these little, wooden...
Right?
Pillows, like the blocks that they sleep on top of. I can't even imagine.
Oh, that sounds awful.
I know. So these women did not go to that extreme. They liked their hair, but not that much. So they actually had these large caps that they would put over the tops of their hair, and it would preserve the integrity of their updo while they were sleeping.
Hmm.
And I can't even imagine. Like I think about my bed, and I'm 5'7". And so, like, when I scoot down too far on the bed so my pillow doesn't fall off, like my feet dangle over. And I'm like, what do you do with, like, 3 feet ahead?
Your whole feet, like, all your legs are dangling off.
Right? Like, your knees are just, like, bent over the edge of the bed.
Absolutely. Yep.
I have a hard enough time sleeping already. I would never have survived that.
No. And especially if it's something that was really expensive that you did for an event and then you kept your hair like that, like I would, I guess maybe I'm just frugal, but the entire time I'd be like, oh, I don't want to sleep because I don't want to mess up my hair because I spent so much money to have this done. And then my friends would be like, girl, you need to wash that because for real, it stinks.
Yeah.
The massive updos were an example of French nobility that, curiously enough, quickly dropped from fashion at the beginning of the French Revolution in 1789. Very if you would imagine.
I can see that.
Yeah, me too. Although I think it'd be hard to put your head in the guillotine with that massive contraption strapped to it. So, I don't know.
And I think they, like, associated it with, like, nobles and royals and...
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, she's hiding. Look, there she is. Follow the hair.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's what I got on wigs. Right.
That was fun.
I'm not going to lie, I totally almost did something on the Merkin, but then I was like, well, I already
Oh my God, you know what? When you were talking about the things that the Egyptian men wore, that totally came to mind.
The beard.
Yes.
I was so
tempted to start talking about the Merkin, and I was like, well, I did already mention the Merkin that one time that we were talking about hygiene and everything. I mean, so if you want to listen to the Merkin, make sure you listen to the hygiene episode. But yes. But I was like, I don't know that I want people thinking I'm like Merkin obsessed. I mean,
but I mean, it is technically a wig, so
I may bring it back again some other day. Yes. We'll hold that for another little fun tidbit.
That's too funny. So I'm going to talk a little bit about belts. People have been wearing belts since at least the Bronze Age. They've been used to hold clothes in place or to put pouches on for carrying items, attach weapons or other tools to. And believe it or not, it's a simple accessory just to show off like beads or a woven style or something to show social status and ranking. They were often made of leather strips, cords, rope, fabric, and eventually metal. So here's a few fun facts about belts. Belts were sometimes called girdles, and not like the girdle you're thinking of from, like, the 1950s that held in ladies' bellies, which I remember the first time I was, like, reading a book, and they talked about, like, oh, she put her girdle on over her gown. I was like, really? It was, like, in a medieval novel. I was like, really? Like, that's so weird. But instead, it's a woven belt from leather, string, or metal. Men wore girdles to hold their tunics in place, but women wore them around their gowns to accentuate the shapes of their body, a practice that all but stopped by the 1700s and then continued again in the 1800s with waist shapers and sashes. By the Renaissance period, women were regularly wearing belts with the changing fashions, and buckles actually around this time grew more fashionable as well, as did chain belts. In the Christian faith, girdles were used to show faith and chastity, with priests even carrying scriptures on their girdles. And ropes worn by Franciscan priests also were formed in knots to show vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience.
So I was totally expecting you to go into a chastity belt.
Me too.
Oh my gosh.
I was too. And I couldn't help because we just watched Robin Hood Men in Tights in her Everlast walk with her. It is the key to the greatest treasure in the land.
You know, after watching that movie, I actually went on a chastity belt binge research thing. And I have seen several of them, when I've gone to different museums or castles in Europe. And I, the thing I always think about with those is hygiene, guys. Ew.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I just cannot imagine.
Well, and they didn't actually really put them into implementation. No. I mean, it's so weird that they have them all, but, it doesn't seem I haven't actually read anything that talks about them actually being in use, but then why do they have them?
I think they definitely probably were in use.
I think they definitely were in use.
That's something we're going to have to research.
Yeah, one of the things I had read at some point, and I'm not sure I'm going to get this right at all because that was probably 15 or 20 years ago, but it the openings near the private areas would mm-hmm. be, they could make them into jagged,
Yes, yeah. I saw. I was just thinking of one that I saw that was like that, and I was thinking of the jagged thing. Yeah,
yeah, and oftentimes, well, at least from what this was, and this could be totally not true. I don't remember where I read it, but husbands or fathers would put it on their wives and daughters when they went off to war to prevent them from being raped. So I think it. I don't know why. I mean, I guess maybe they could have put it on for someone they wanted to remain a virgin, but. Who was maybe promiscuous, but from what the thing I read, it was more a preventative measure of them being raped. So.
Hmm. Right. You have to think about the guys that are little enough to still fit it in with those jackets.
Oh.
Yikes.
But yeah, I had read also, too, that sometimes it was for men who were worried that their wives would be unfaithful to them while they were gone.
Yeah, that too.
To ensure that their children were indeed their children. So, but yeah, I remember when I was, because we went to this really, when I lived in Germany when I was younger, we went to this incredible museum. It was the Torture Museum in Rothenburg, Germany, and it's the most awesome I mean, of course, I have the most vivid memories of it because as a kid, I was like, whoa, you know?
Yeah.
And it's funny because my parents were talking, I guess, that they'd gone on like an anniversary trip. They were talking about this a couple weeks ago. Oh, yeah, the anniversary trip we took to Rotenburg. And I was like, man, that place had an incredible torture museum. And they both stopped and looked at me and they're like, really? That's what you remember about Rotenburg? Yes. And I was like, oh, yeah. That place was awesome.
Adding to the list of places I now need to go.
Oh, it's so cool. But yeah, so they had a bunch of chastity belts there. They had like the Iron Maidens. They had... We should do an episode on torture.
That would be so much fun.
Oh, we should.
This is... I know that sounds almost gleeful of me, but seriously, this stuff was so fascinating.
I'm very excited about it. I have this really good book. I can't remember the exact title of it, but it's something like A Thousand Ways in Which You Can Die, and it's all about torture in like... history, and it's really
good. That sounds really good.
It might be like A Thousand Cuts or some, I don't know, it's some crazy title.
Right.
But yeah, that would be a really fun episode.
Oh, yes, it definitely would. Okay, sorry, we totally digressed, Eliza.
Yeah, so sorry.
Back to belts. Within the military, differing colors of girdles showed rank and allegiance on the battlefield. So, you know, when they're going into like a great melee, like, they're all... not necessarily wouldn't know who's who. You're kind of in the fray of just, like, battle, but you could see...
I've always wondered about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Eventually, you know, uniforms were different colors, but for the meantime, like, you could see the belt. And it also showed the ranking within the military. So, by the 15th century, belts were no longer only a symbol of status, but necessity. Often they were long leather straps that looped around the waist and left a long, excessive tail at the front. So... they were really
funny. Okay, I know where your mind is going.
That's like, I was going to say, well, that's rather presumptuous.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny. So they were, like, really at that point, like, with the costuming and everything that people were wearing, they needed belts to hold their clothes in place. So something else about belts. While a lot of belts and girdles were typically tied in place, belt buckles do go back to the Iron Age, which, you know, would connect the two sides of a belt together. Prior to buckles being used as on belts, they had been used on chin straps of helmets. Baldrics, which is a type of belt that's strapped around the shoulder and back, often held weapons. And that dates back to, like, the Roman times and probably even before that. Buckles could be a great decorative piece, having, like, a family crest on it or some, you know, something... your family motto. For a more prominent person, they could even be made of gold and encrusted with jewels. Last week when I was in New York City at the cloisters owned by the Met Museum, they had all these different jewels and things in their like little treasure room. Well, it was a large treasure room, but there were several of these really ornate buckles and pins and things like that. And it's just amazing to me because like belts, you don't think about belts so much nowadays as being like this huge status of symbol and wealth. Unless you get, like, a Gucci
not,
one, I guess.
Unless you're on the rodeo circuit.
Yeah, right? I was going to think, like, cowboys still do it, and, like, bikers and stuff, but a normal everyday person, you're like, oh, I'll just go grab a belt at Target, no big deal, I just need something to hold my jeans up. But they were, like, this huge thing, like, actually, like, a big accessory and a jewelry item for them. There were a bunch of different types of buckles. There's a frame-style buckle, which is the oldest version, and actually it's probably the most common version that we use today. And that's where you have a metal frame, and there's a prong in the middle that moves to push through a hole in the leather, and then leaves a little strap that you can weave through the end to connect it. These were appearing around the 8th century, which I have to be honest, like, I didn't realize, and I haven't really done much research on belt buckles before, but one of the things I always avoid writing in my historicals is anything about buckles, because I thought that they were a much more modern invention. I think that, I got
that's pretty cool that it goes back that far. I never would have guessed that either.
No, I'm pretty sure someone along the way told me that they didn't have buckles and I just believed them rather than looking. So I'm definitely going to start including those from now on. Then there was also a plate style buckle, which I definitely remember this from my childhood having a few of these types of belts. And it featured a metal plate that had like several prongs on it that were not movable. They were soldered on and then hooked into like the specific holes in the leather strap. And those were especially common among soldiers. So they were very, like, they were fitted. So it wasn't, like, where you pull it tight to fit in the hole. Like, it was actually fitted, and you weren't going to be adjusting it. I guess you could, like, mm-hmm. drill a new one into it.
Yeah, I actually have a dress. I have a dress that has a belt like that.
That's cool.
So, yeah.
So there's still here today,
Yeah. You know, and I was listening to, you know, I'm listening to my great courses now, and I'm loving them so much. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that he had mentioned was a belt, or like a buckle that was found. And the funny thing is about this buckle is that it looks like a really super fancy ornate buckle, right?
Yeah.
But it's really just a face for an ordinary buckle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's like if you wanted to have like this like super awesome buckle that was still legit functional and wasn't hard to open and everything, like it was like a, I thought that was so funny. It's like a fake buckle on top of your buckle.
The next topic I want to talk about is suspenders. My husband really loves suspenders. He wears, with his jeans, he'll wear belts, and then with his dress clothes for work, he often wears suspenders, and I have the most fun going up and snapping the suspenders.
I bet that is fun.
It's really fun. And, you know, he's like, it hurts, but he laughs about it because, like, I don't know, we started dating when we were teenagers, so I can't tell you how many times he used to snap my bra, and now I'm like, oh, I'm getting your back! So, the first pair of suspenders traces back to the 1700s, and believe it or not, Benjamin Franklin is said to have worn them. They were made of ribbons and looped through buttonholes in the pants. In the early 1800s, fashion for men in Britain changed so that their trousers grew higher up around the waist. I'm sure you guys all remember, like, think about, like, Pride and Prejudice, where the pants are very high-waisted. Mm-hmm.
Man, high-rise leggings are getting all the way back to Regency era.
Right? Mm-hmm. Exactly. So at that time, it became really hard to wear a belt, like, up around your ribcage. It just seemed silly. And so the men started wearing suspenders, but they called them braces. They attached to the pants via leather loopholes or buttons. You could have buttons. And then the suspenders themselves were made of tightly woven box cloth. Hmm. They attached in the back, either in an uppercase H pattern, and then they moved to a familiar X pattern, and then the Y. I think all three of these are still widely used today. Samuel Clemens, a.k.a. Mark Twain, held the first patent in the U.S. for adjustable and detachable straps for garments, which were basically suspenders, but he found suspenders to be uncomfortable, so he made a new design for them, and they attached to everything from trousers to women's corsets. By 1894, metal clasps were added to the suspenders, which is what you see today, instead of them having to be, like, pants having to be made with these leather loopholes or buttons that were specifically for suspenders.
Hmm, very that's interesting. Cool. Yeah. And, you know, I think I've seen somebody recently wearing some with the loopholes and the buttons.
Oh, really?
I think I have.
It's probably still, I mean, it's functional, so why not, right?
Yeah. Plus, I know, like, you guys know I'm a huge Disney World fan.
Yeah.
And they have these things twice a year. It's called Dapper Day.
Yeah.
And it's, like, where everybody dresses up, like, 1940s. And, like, these guys come in with, like, these, like, pants with their little, with the button-up shirt. And then they've got their suspenders and, like, a little straw hat and everything. It's awesome.
That's cool. I
so,
like that.
Yeah.
That does sound cool.
Dapper indeed. So, now we are moving on to what we are reading. My book this week is Year of Wonders by Geraldine Brooks, and this is a book that, you guys know I've been, like, really researching the plague and everything lately for my book that I'm writing. So this is a book based on, this one's actually during the 17th century, about the Black Death, and oh my gosh, it's so incredibly good.
I love the plague, so I can't wait to read this.
This book is amazing. Mm-hmm. So here's what it's about. When an infected bolt of cloth carries plague from London to an isolated village, a housemaid named Anna Frith emerges as an unlikely heroine and healer. Through Anna's eyes, we follow the story of the fateful year of 1666. Maybe that's where 666 comes from. I don't know. Anyways. As she and her fellow villagers confront the spread of disease and superstition, as death reaches into every household and villagers turn from prayers to murderous witch hunting, Anna must find the strength to confront the disintegration of her community and the lure of illicit love. As she struggles to survive and grow, a year of catastrophe becomes instead Annus Mirabilis, a year of wonders. Inspired by the true story of Eam, a village in a rugged hill country of England, Year of Wonders is a richly detailed evocation of a singular moment in history.
That sounds really good.
It's really good.
So intriguing.
I've read this book probably about, I mean, seriously, like six times. I've read it by itself, like as a physical book, for probably about four or five times. And then I've actually listened to it on Audible a couple of times, and she actually reads it.
I was going to ask if it was on Audible, and I get so excited when the author asks.
And here's the thing, like, a lot of people don't like her reading it because she has sort of like a monotone sort of voice, and she almost sounds like somebody who's bored all the time. Mm-hmm. But honestly, I feel like that may sound bad, I don't know, but the tone of her voice is so perfect for that time period, for what she's going through, because I would imagine that if I was living through something like that, I would feel like I was dead inside as I'm telling everything. Yeah. So it actually kind of, in this weird way, like, makes it even better. I liked it.
It probably helps evoke the emotions that she wants to get across.
Yeah. Yes, because even when horrible things happen, she's still telling it, like, in this kind of deadpan voice. I like it, actually.
That's
so
very cool. Adding to the list.
Yeah.
So this week, I'm actually reading it right now, is Meet Me in Monaco by Hazel Gaynor and Heather Webb. I met them both. Well, Heather's one of my really good friends. We're in the Ribbons of Scarlet book together. And I got to meet Hazel, her writing partner, at the Historical Novel Society conference in June. And then I just saw her again while I was in New York and got both of them to sign the book for me, which is like, I love having signed books by my friends. It's a really, really good book so far. Set in the 1950s against the backdrop of Grace Kelly's whirlwind romance and unforgettable wedding to Prince Rainer of Monaco, New York Times bestselling author Hazel Gaynor and Heather Webb take the reader on an evocative sun-drenched journey along the Côte d'Azur in this page-turning novel of passion, fate, and second chances. Movie stars and paparazzi flock to Cannes for the glamorous film festival, but Grace Kelly, the biggest star of all, wants only to escape from the flash bulbs when struggling perfumer Sophie Duval shelters Miss Kelly in her boutique to fend off a persistent British press photographer, James Henderson. A bond is forged between the two women and sets in motion a chain of events that stretches across 30 years of friendship, love, and tragedy. James Henderson cannot forget his brief encounter with Sophie Duval. Despite his guilt at being away from his daughter, he takes an assignment to cover the wedding of the century, sailing with Grace Kelly's wedding party on the SS Constitution from New York. In Monaco, as wedding fever soars and passions and tempers escalate, James and Sophie, like Princess Grace, must ultimately decide what they are prepared to give up for love.
Well, that sounds really good.
It's really super good. It does sound really good. I'm really, really loving it. And it's like all the glamour and suspense and love and everything all in one. And I do apologize for the crying baby sound, if you could hear that. My nephew's
here. It's okay.
I think he's sleepy.
Aw, it's totally okay.
Yeah, it happens. I'll take that over kids fighting any day anyway.
Yeah.
That's at least like, aw.
Aw, he's a little baby. He's so cute.
Right.
So, and this week, I've been reading Hanukkah stories again for that Hanukkah anthology that I've got coming out, but I have also just downloaded an audiobook that I'm going to listen to, and I haven't started it yet, but it sounds really good. So I'm going from Hanukkah to suspense.
It's like a big transition, but
yes.
I love
So this one is called The Couple Next Door by Sherry Lapina. It all started at a dinner party. A domestic suspense debut about a young couple and their apparently friendly neighbors. A twisty roller coaster ride of lies, betrayal, and the secrets between husbands and wives. Anne and Marco Conti seem to have it all. A loving relationship, a wonderful home, and their beautiful baby, Cora. But one night, when they are at a dinner party next door, a terrible crime is committed. Suspicion immediately lands on the parents, but the truth is a much more complicated story. Inside the curtained house, an unsettling account of what actually happened unfolds. Detective Rossbach knows that the panicked couple is hiding something. Both Anne and Marco soon discover that the other is keeping secrets. Secrets they've kept for years. What follows is the nerve-wracking unraveling of a family, a chilling tale of deception, duplicity, and unfaithfulness that will keep you breathless until the final shocking twist.
Wow, that sounds so
good. Wow, that sounds really good.
I'll let you guys know how it is. I haven't started it yet, but I'm about to.
Oh, that sounds good.
That sounds really, really good. So now we're talking about our books this week, and I actually had a release on Tuesday.
Yay!
So this was Ella's Desire. This is the third book of my Borderland Ladies series. A woman with dreams of love. Lady Ella Barrington is a romantic who has always dreamed she would marry for love, but when loyalties are questioned, she must sacrifice her dreams to save her father. Her handsome betrothed seems to be the hero she's always hoped for and awakens a yearning she never imagined, but her belief in fairy tale love crumbles as truth comes to light and danger lurks. A man with everything to lose. Bronson Berkeley is the new Earl of Calville, a title that comes with staggering revelations. He learns not only did his father leave a mountain of debt, but he also sorely neglected Bronson's stepmother and half-sister. When the king makes him an offer that will save his family from ruin, Bronson quickly agrees to wed Lady Ella. But when her longing is easily stoked with his courtier's charm, he discovers her love is the true prize and will require the unveiling of his own guarded heart to win. Will desire bring them together or tear them apart? Attraction sizzles between them, even after dreams are crushed. But when the reality of life in the Borderlands threatens both their families, can Ella and Bronson mend the cracks between them in time to keep everyone safe? With the lines between love and lust blurred by passion, will unmasking their souls reveal the love of a lifetime, or will desire cost them everything?
That sounds so
good.
Oh, your
it does are sound amazing. And congratulations.
Yes. Thank you. Yay. Thank you, ladies.
Cheers to that.
Yes. Yay, I'll drink to that.
My book that I'm sharing this week is Savage of the Sea. It's the first book in the Pirates of Britannia Lords of the Sea series. A daring brotherhood where honor among thieves reigns supreme, and crushing their enemies is a thrilling pastime. These are the Pirates of Britannia. When a Highland pirate prince, Shaw Savage MacDougall, was invited to a deadly feast, he didn't know that saving a wee lass would forever change his future. A lady with a dangerous secret. Lady Jane Lindsay, widowed at a young age, seeks refuge from her departed husband's vengeful enemies. For 5 years, she sought a secret that could cost her everything, including her life. When her safety is compromised, she reaches out to the only man who's protected her in the past and offers him a bounty he cannot refuse. A Highland pirate determined to save her. Shaw's life is perfect. Whiskey, women, and mayhem. He wants for nothing until Lady Jane presents a treasure he'd never considered possessing. Is he willing to risk his lethal reputation in order to save a lass he barely knows again? Will she trust a pirate to see their arrangement through to the end? And what happens when perilous battles turn to sinful kisses? Who will save them from each other?
Ooh, that sounds good.
It does sound very
Thank
good.
Thank you.
Yeah,
it's
I like
really
that.
Good book to write. I enjoyed writing that one. I enjoy writing all the books, but I really love that one.
And plus, like, now, after having watched Once Upon a Time.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
With Killian as Hook. Hook.
Yeah.
Oh, my
really,
God.
Really
every time I read Pirate, I always think of him in my head with, like, that sweet little lovesick look that he gives as he's always, like, chasing Emma around.
Oh, that's so funny. So, tonight, I am talking about Highland Salvation, and that is book 4 in my Highland Pride series. Finlay Cameron, the bastard son of an English earl and a Scottish mother, weds stunning, outgoing Blair McNab to ensure her clan's loyalty to King Charles. She's everything he's ever wanted in a wife, but he suspects she may be plotting his murder. Always considered to be nothing more than a pretty face, Blair McNab yearns to prove her worth. She refuses to be used as a pawn for political gain. But when confronted by a blackmailer, her only option is to marry the brawny Finlay Cameron. In Finlay's arms, she feels safe for the first time ever, until she learns that her blackmailer is hot on her trail and her secrets could soon be exposed.
Ooh.
That sounds very good.
Thank you. I had a lot of fun writing this one.
Yeah, I bet. That sounds awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So now we've come to the part in our podcast where we answer questions from readers. This week's question is, what is your favorite historical movie?
And I will go first. Mine right now is The King's Speech.
I love that one.
I thought this was an amazing movie. Yeah. It's the story of King George VI and his very quick accession to the throne of the British Empire in, I think it was 1936. and he had a speech problem. So this is the story of him and his speech therapist and him overcoming his issues and just turning into the leader that he always was inside and projecting that on the outside. And it's such an amazing story. And I smiled and I cried and it was beautiful.
I really love that.
Mm-hmm. I don't think I've seen that one. I think I need to see that one.
Yes, you do.
You do.
I think it won a lot of awards.
It did.
Next movie night, I will be probably sending you a text message. What was the name of that again?
Yeah.
It
definitely needs to. It was really good and totally worth watching.
I think my favorite is Dangerous Beauty. Oh, I don't know if you guys have ever seen that.
I've never seen that.
Yeah, it's about, it actually takes place in Venice during the plague years, so it's like around the 17th century. Mm-hmm. And the woman is actually a courtesan, and the hero is a courtier. And they have always loved each other, but, you know, they have different paths. And so he has to become a courtier, and he has to have an arranged marriage. And she's just devastated. And it's a great opening because, like, you know, like they're devastated because they can't be together because he's rich and she's poor. And so she has to be a servant and he has to go and marry somebody who he's not in love with. Oh, the medieval ages or medieval days. So her mother comes in and tells her, well, you can still have him, just not the way that you think. Then she proceeds to tell her daughter that she was a famous courtesan, one of the best. And so she trains her daughter to become a courtesan so that she can still have the man that she loves. And it's such a good, good story. And the costumes are beautiful and she's very sharp-witted. And so the dialogue is so incredibly wonderful, like the banter between them. And it's lyrical and beautiful. And I highly, highly recommend it. In fact, I want to watch it because I haven't seen it in years. Now I really want to watch it again. So
I'm going to have to watch that too.
It's super good.
It's really good. This was such a hard question to answer because I literally have so many that I adore. But I had to pick Rob Roy, which features Liam Neeson, and I think that was the first time I ever fell in love with Liam Neeson.
That is such a good movie.
It's really good. And actually, while we were in... It's based on Robert Roy McGregor, who actually was a real person. And while we were in Scotland, we were driving... It must have been like on the Isle of Skye, and we passed this brown sign that had two swords crisscrossing on the side of the road, just random. So I was like, pull over, what is that? And it ended up being like the battle place of Glen Shields, they had marked it with this sign. And when I looked it up, he had been there. That was somewhere he had been. So I was like, oh my god,
so
like,
cool.
It was just really a cool moment. But Rob Roy, the movie, I believe is actually based on the book that was written by Sir Walter Scott, which is considered one of his Waverley novels. Mm-hmm. But it's basically about a Scotsman who's wronged. He's trying to fight for his clan and family against some noblemen. So he's almost like the first, or not the first, he's like almost like a Robin Hood of Scotland. But it's just really good. You've got to watch it. There's really a lot of emotion in it. And then obviously, like, Kilts and Liam Neeson, like, you should watch it for just that part.
But it's a really good movie.
It is a really good movie. I've seen it a couple times.
It's really, really good. So this is, like, you know, recommended in triplicate here.
Yes.
So
go watch all of these movies this weekend. Put it on your list.
Yes. So now maybe we should ask readers, what are your favorite historical movies? Share with us, because we're always looking for something
new
to watch.
Yes.
So write in and let us know, what are your favorite historical movies?
Or send us any other questions that you may have that you would like for us to answer on air.
Yes.
You can email us at historybooksandwine@gmail.com.
So next month we're going to be talking about spies. We love spies.
Unfortunately, we don't really know exactly what we're going to be talking about regarding spies, because have we mentioned that this week has been insane for us?
Yes.
But it'll be about spies.
Yes.
It will be awesome.
Yeah. The next four podcasts will be all about spies.
Yes, awesome and spies wine stuff. And awesomeness,
yes.
And it'll be great.
Yes. We hope you guys are all having a really good summer, too.
Yes, definitely. And having a lot of good wine.
Yes.
So if you'd like to check out our website, it is historybooksandwine.buzzsprout.com. We'll have the show notes for today's episode listed there. They can also be found on iTunes with our podcast. We are now on Spotify, SoundCloud, Google, and Alexa. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
If you like what you heard today, please leave us a review. And remember, you can always send us questions at historybooksandwine@gmail.com. We hope you enjoyed hearing about some of our fun historical tidbits.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Be sure to check out new episodes published weekly on Thursday. Next up is myself, Eliza, on August 8th, discussing spies. Madeline on August 15th, talking about spies. Lori on August 22nd, more spies! And our next happy hour is August 29th, and we'll be dishing on all things spies!
Spies!
We're out later, but you're going to be in for some great spying surprises.
Yes, lots of espionage.
Right? It's such a mystery, we don't even know it yet.
Yes. Have a great week, everyone.
Bye.
Have a great week. Bye.